The McAlpines exchanged jolly greetings with the Lauritsens and pronounced themselves pleased to meet me.
"How's the collecting going?" Peter asked.
"I've sold everything," Lord McAlpine trumpeted.
"That must be a wrenching thing to do," said Peter.
"Not at all. I have the soul of a nomad and set little store by possessions. I am anxious in their pursuit and casual in their disposal.
But I'll admit, I'm rather wistful about my collection of garden implements, especially the horse-drawn lawnmower with leather shoes for the horse's hooves to protect the lawn. I put all of it under the hammer."
"Why all?" asked Peter.
"To rid myself of the chore of making a choice."
"You haven't given up collecting altogether, have you?" Rose asked.
"No, no. I'm always onto something new. I've become interested in neckties in a small way. I've picked up a few good ones."
"Oh, Alistair, why not just tell them?" said his wife. "He's got about 4,000 neckties at this point." I was fascinated by the McAlpines, but I could not help imagining the sounds of bombs and sirens going off in counterpoint to their small talk. The fact that they were wearing masks, his being a harlequin style, hers a mass of pink sequins, lent a touch of farce to the notion that they were on the run from the IRA. As soon as they moved on, I asked Rose what she had meant by hiding out from the IRA. "That's why they're here. After the IRA bombed their house in London, they decided to move to Australia, but the London CID told them, 'Don't be silly, all the worst killers in the IRA hide out in Australia.' So, naturally, they asked where it would be safe to go, and funnily enough, the police told them Venice. And it's true. In Venice, you're very likely to be swindled or have your pocket picked, but you almost certainly won't be kidnapped or murdered."
"What's to stop someone from just shooting you?" I asked. "Or blowing up your house?"
"Nothing. That would be easy. Escaping would be the hard part, because the police can seal off all the escape routes within minutes. They can close the bridge to the mainland and alert the water taxis, and, of course, it would be sheer madness for anybody to try making a getaway in a boat by himself. The lagoon may look like a tranquil pond, but it's really very treacherous. One has to know all about the currents, the channels, the sandbars, the tides, the speed limit, and the meaning of all the buoys and signal lights. Anyway, the boat would probably be noticed by all the boatmen in the lagoon. They all know every boat. And anyone who wanted to kidnap you would somehow have to drag you out of the house, down the Calais or whatever, and into a boat without being seen. And that would be impossible, because everywhere in Venice, the eyes are watching. And unless the kidnapper was an experienced Venetian boatman himself, he'd have to hire one as an accomplice, and that would complicate matters endlessly. So nobody bothers. Anyway, the murder rate in Venice is practically nil, and that's why rich Italians took apartments here when the Red Brigades were marauding in the 1980s.
"Rose has been reading too many mystery stories," said Peter.
Just then, Count Girolamo Marcello walked past, engrossed in conversation with another man.
"A disgrace," he was saying with a curious smile. "A disaster.
But actually, it has not been all bad. Before the Fenice burned, my television reception was very poor. Now I get all the channels with perfect clarity." Marcello had gained approval for the burial of his friend, the Russian poet Joseph Brodsky, in the cemetery at San Michele, and that, too, had cheered him. Within half an hour, the crowd began drifting toward the stairs and up to the second piano nobile, where waiters in white tunics stood behind two long buffet tables laden with food. Platters of thinly sliced prosciutto and air-dried beef, tureens of vegetable and shrimp risotto, baked zucchini, and serving dishes heaped with an array of Venetian specialties, including calves' liver and onions, squid and polenta, and a creamy baccalà mantecato.